Okay, so this is then the fourth talk in this series of talks about the path of happiness, or the path to happiness, or the path which is happiness. All of these apply here. And as always, the purpose of these things is to make these talks very practical, so we can actually put them into practice in our daily lives, and we can use them to actually get somewhere with this Buddhist practice of ours. So today I'm going to talk about another aspect of this path, and it is an aspect which may sound very, maybe very profound and very deep, but it's still very potentially very practical and very useful if we actually use it correctly. And today it's going to be about Samatha and Vipassana, is what it's the title of the talk today. And these two qualities, Samatha and Vipassana, usually translated as Samatha, as calm, Vipassana, very often translated as insight. Well, these two factors are basically the entire Buddhist path from the very beginning to the very end can be understood in terms of these qualities, Samatha, Vipassana, calm and insight. So these are like summaries, if you like, of the entire Buddhist path from the beginning, from the end. So understanding these qualities is therefore very, very useful, because then you can understand how the practice proceeds all the way along, and why and how it gives the results that it actually does. First of all, I'm going to describe Samatha very briefly, what it's all about, this calming of the mind. Then I'm going to talk about Vipassana, and then I'm going to show how they actually work together. And then I'm going to give some practical examples towards the end of how to use these techniques to actually, in our daily life, to enhance our practice of Buddhism. So Samatha, which means calming the mind, this is something we start from the very beginning. When you undertake the five precepts, you undertake a moral code in your life, already, just by doing that much, you started to calm down. Because if you don't have a moral code, if you have a sense of remorse in your mind, it agitates the mind. It doesn't make the mind peaceful. But if you have a moral code, you don't have a sense of remorse or badness for the things that you have done, then the mind is already much calmer. So just that much, just living a good life, undertaking the five precepts, is already a very good start for calmness. So this is how it starts off, and then it goes by stage upwards. So the next stage is something usually called sense restraint in Buddhism, whereby we try to avoid getting upset and also having too much desire for things in the world. Because again, being upset, having ill will and desire upsets the mind. It's the opposite of calm. So sense restraint, by holding back on these things, calms the mind down, makes the mind beautiful and peaceful. And again, the next step here is mindfulness. We talked about mindfulness the other day. If you are mindful, it means that you are in the present moment. And that present moment awareness, being here and now, not being off in the past and the future, again, is a sense of peace, because the mind is not running around. It is here and now, where we are now. It's a beautiful sense of peace in its own right. Then that calm goes on to the samadhi, the deep meditation. That's when we start to get really, really peaceful. And ultimately, that calm goes all the way to full enlightenment, where the mind is no longer possible to disturb the mind. So you can see here the purpose I'm saying this, because the calm is something which goes throughout the path, from the beginning to the very end. The entire path can be understood as a process of calming down more and more and more, ultimately till you reach the highest sort of calm. So that is the calming aspect of the path. And it starts off from the very beginning. The other side is the Vipassana side of the path. Now, Vipassana is often translated as insight, but a translation which I find very useful for Vipassana, instead of insight, is clear seeing, seeing clearly. And quite literally, that is quite possibly the actual meaning of Vipassana, seeing clearly. Instead of having a foggy mind, instead of having all kind of troubles coming up in the mind, we see clearly. What is it that we see clearly? And what we see clearly is the world and things as they actually are. This is known as yatha bhuta jnanadasana in the Pali language. It's a fairly well-known term. So we are seeing things as they actually are. And I find it so One of the wonderful things about Buddhism is precisely that what we are endeavoring to do is to see things in accordance with reality. Buddhism is not about false comforts from false ideals, false kind of ways of doing things. Buddhism is about confronting the truth head on, finding out about reality. That is what Buddhism is about. And because Buddhism is precisely about finding out what reality is, it means that when we eventually take comfort in that reality, it means that we're taking comfort in something solid, not something which is just a figment of our imagination, but we're taking comfort in the truth. This idea in society that ignorance is bliss is the exact opposite of the idea of Buddhism. Ignorance is suffering in Buddhism. So understanding things as they actually are is the way out of that suffering. And I find it so beautiful because it means that Buddhism, for example, is not opposed to science. In a sense, Buddhism is just an aspect of truth. It's finding out about the truth in the same way as science is figuring out the truth. It's just a slightly different area, and it's much more personal than science is. Science is obviously in the public sphere. And that fact that Buddhism is compatible with science is one of the things that, for me, which makes Buddhism a very very beautiful system. Anything where I have to set aside something which is so fundamental to modern society as scientific truth make it very difficult for me to believe in that kind of system. So I find this one of the beautiful things about Buddhism, that we are searching for truth, we are searching for reality, we are searching for things as they actually are. So what is it that we're actually searching for? What is this truth and reality? It sounds good that we're searching for it. It's good to have a few hints on the way. Otherwise, we might be fumbling around in the dark, not really finding out. And of course, that's the whole purpose of having the Buddha, having gone before us. He already found these truths. Because he found these truths, we already have a guide to show us what these realities are that we're trying to search for. And in brief, these realities are what we call the three characteristics of existence, the three marks of existence, the mark of impermanence, the mark of suffering, and the mark of non-self. This is what it is all about. So what do these three marks actually mean? What does impermanence, suffering, and non-self mean in Buddhism? What is it that we're trying to figure out? What is it that we're trying to see clearly here? And impermanence just means just that. It means things are impermanent. And it is something which goes extremely deeply. It goes to all aspects of existence. And that is why it is so fascinating. But it also goes to the most superficial levels. If you look around you in the world, you look at the way things are, whether it is material things like structures, like buildings in the world, whether anything around you, your possession, your house, your car, you will very quickly see that all of these things are impermanent. It's not very difficult to see. It doesn't take that much insight to realize that this is the case. And then, of course, it goes deeper. You realize your body is impermanent. We're going to die eventually. We're going to get older. We're going to get sick. The body is impermanent. And eventually, at the most profound level, you realize that the mind itself is permeated through and through with impermanence. There's nothing in there which is absolutely solid. And to this extent, you can see that how far-ranging this impermanence is. It goes to the very core of things. It's everywhere. And it's very useful to reflect on this, because although we realize that things are impermanent around us, we tend to forget about it. We tend to treat the world as if things are permanent rather than impermanent. It's one of those natural tendencies in the human being. So that is the first characteristic. The second characteristic of existence is the characteristics of suffering. And that follows from the first characteristic. It follows from the characteristics of impermanence. Why is that? Well, it is because if something is impermanent and we desire, we have attachment for something which is impermanent, what happens when it changes? You have suffering. If you're attached to something and that thing disappears, it changes for you. It is painful. And we all know that. We know that from our lives when somebody who is close to us gets ill or if they die, it's painful. Why is it painful? Because of attachment. It also happens with our belongings to a lesser extent. That is why impermanence is suffering by nature. That's how it works. And finally, there is the characteristics of non-self, and it follows from the first two ones. If everything is impermanent, then there is nothing solid inside of us which we can take to be I, me, or mine. This is me. There is no such thing in there. And that is the idea of non-self. That is the most profound and most Buddhist of these three characteristics, the non-self idea. So I will give you a very easy and simple example how to contemplate impermanence. And this is an example from my own life as a monk. This is one very simple way which I sometimes use to contemplate this impermanence. And this is in our monastery. I'm often involved with the building work in the monastery. I don't know why that is, but that's the way it is. I think one reason is because ever since I was a small child, I had this interest for building work. And my mother tells me that when I was 2 years old, I would stand in the window and watch all this machinery just working away. And I would stand there for hours, mesmerized by this machinery. So I obviously have some kind of defilement there from a past life, being very interested in machinery and building work. And I can see that in the monastery, because sometimes I can see, I get almost like you get a bit obsessed by the building work. It's like you get into it so much that you there's a desire and a craving and an attachment to those buildings they're putting up. Your mind loses its clarity and you start to put things up and you get a bit obsessed by it. And I realize this is not right. I shouldn't be doing this. I should be, when I work with putting up buildings, I should be clear and calm and relaxed in that. That's the only right way of doing it. So I remind myself, these buildings are impermanent. These buildings are not always going to be there. And then I start to look at these buildings. And from the very beginning, even as you're putting them up, you can already start to see the flaws. Sometimes things aren't quite perfect. A brick is a little bit chipped in the corner. Things are a bit cracked here and cracked there. The paint isn't exactly where it should be. Somewhere it is in the wrong place. And all these little things, from the very beginning, things are starting to go wrong. That's the initial kind of, if you like, impermanence. The bricks that you put in are already falling apart, even before you put them into the cutie. That's how impermanent things are. Then I start to look at the older cuties, the older huts in the monastery. And when you start to look at the older ones, you start to see that they're actually falling apart. You start to see that there are bricks coming off in the corner, there's rust coming up in the corners, there is the walking path, the planks are coming off, as you see it. And you start to actually see, well, yeah, this really isn't permanent. When you look at it closely, it is very, very obvious. And then I bring that reflection even further. I reflect to myself, well, what is it going to look like in 50 years' time? What is it going to look like in 100 years' time? What about 200 years' time? And you can create this movie inside of your head of the cutie slowly but surely degenerating, falling apart one brick at a time, the rust spreading across the metal and the steel that we have in those cuties. And it's very easy to visualize, because we all have seen derelict buildings in our life and we know how these things happen. And eventually that impermanence goes to the stage where there's only ruins left of that cutie, of that particular hut. And then, of course, there comes a stage when there's only ruins left. At one stage in the future, there might be archaeologists coming to that site, digging out that cutie and say, oh, look at this, amazing. There must have been a Buddhist monastery here once, right? That's what you find. And then eventually, even beyond that, maybe in 2,000 years' time, there's just these tiny little piles of rubble with the grass growing over it. And then people come and say, look at this. This must surely have been a Christian monastery once, because it's impossible there can have been Buddhism in Australia. Australia was far away from Asia. This must have been a Christian monastery. And at that point, you realize that everything is pretty much lost. Everything which was Buddhist even is completely lost, and there's almost nothing left. And this is the power of impermanence. It deletes things, erases things from existence so absolutely and completely that nothing is left remaining here. And eventually, those bricks and that steel, they would be so deteriorated and so turned back into sand, back into dust, back into the original elements, that there would be absolutely nothing left. Buddhism will have vanished from the surface of the earth. and maybe not to be seen again for a long, long, long time, and everything will be gone absolutely, completely. There will be no memory of any of us sitting here. We will have been completely erased from history, absolutely. That is impermanence for you. Incredibly powerful force, which erases things absolutely, ultimately, absolutely, and completely. And when I think of that, when I look at that cutie and I remember that it is impermanent, it's going to fall apart, then somehow that subdues that attachment, that desire for that cutie. Somehow I realize that that impermanence in itself is enough to cool my mind down and to make it fit for having a reasonable relationship with that cutie rather than one of attachment. And then actually what happens then, you do a better job because you do exactly what is required. You do what is needed. You don't go too far. You don't get perfectionistic and do all kind of over-the-top things. So that cool mind, which is not attached, which doesn't have too much craving and desire in it, is a mind much more suitable for doing what is right and what is appropriate. So that is just to give you a very simple example of how to contemplate impermanence in life. And you can use that kind of contemplation in so many areas in life. In your own life, if you see that there are things that you are attached to, you can just do that and it will cool you down a little bit. And it can be extremely useful in that sense. So, what is it? How does this actually work? Why is it that when you watch something impermanent like that, why is it actually that it cools you down? Well, just theoretically speaking, just like I was showing you the example now, what is happening there is that when you see the impermanence, you understand that it's suffering to attach to it. So because it's suffering to attach to it, the mind lets go like that. That is the mechanism there. You understand that if you attach to what is impermanent, it will lead to suffering. So the mind lets go automatically. It's a bit like when you go back to your house and you put your hand on the hot plate to see if it's hotter. And it's hot and your hand just withdraws straight away. You don't even have to, if you do it by accident, you don't even have to think that I should withdraw my hand from the hot plate. It happens by itself, automatically. And it's exactly the same thing with the mind. When the mind understands that something is suffering because it's impermanent, there is an automatic withdrawal by the mind from that thing. You don't have to will it to happen. It just happens by itself. And that, of course, is the idea of insight, the idea of contemplation, of clear seeing. We see things clearly, and we withdraw from things which are suffering. That's the purpose of this. So the next thing I want to talk about is how samatha vipassana, calm and insight, or calm and clear seeing, how they interact with each other. And this is very important because you find that in the suttas of the Buddha, the way the Buddha actually explained this, samatha and vipassana always go together. They go as pairs together. Why is it that they go as pairs? Why is it that these things are so closely related? And the point here is that when we calm the mind down, well, what is happening when we calm the mind down? The most important thing that we are calming down when the mind gets calmed down is the defilements. We are getting rid of the defilements because the defilements tend to make the mind run around, look